This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station. Community Amplified.
We worked really, really hard, and we always made sure that we were on message and that we were talking to the residents of Baltimore County. And I think that the hard work there and the engagement with the community is really what resonated in this race.
What else resonated with Baltimore County voters this election? I'm News Director Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's News Roundup. Today, with the votes finally in, we examine Baltimore County results. Then, tremors from Venezuela's deadly earthquakes felt in Baltimore, and the history of one Maryland law, now a documentary.
Law enforcement officers are the only persons that have a legal right to kill. And with that right that they have, there's a great amount of responsibility that should go along with it, but it doesn't.
And stay tuned for dessert, ice cream, all around Maryland. That's all coming up. Good afternoon, and welcome to the WYPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, News Director of the award-winning WYPR Newsroom. After 2 weeks of counting, results are official from June's primary election. WYPR's Baltimore County reporter John Lee is here to update us on the winners as we look forward to the general election in November. Saptam Bansal with our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, will also be on to talk about the results of public funding. This was the first year candidates in Baltimore County were given the option of public campaign funds. Some benefited, some maybe need a little more help. More than 2 weeks after two deadly earthquakes took thousands of lives in Venezuela, we speak to a Venezuelan in Baltimore, who's also the founder of one of the city's most popular Spanish-language media outlets, and hear about how it's resonating here. And Maryland's history with the law enforcement officer Bill of Rights is the subject of a new documentary streaming on Maryland Public Television. We'll hear from the filmmaker and women who made its repeal their mission. Finally, ice cream. Where to get it? Who's making it? And now you can burn some calories while consuming it all around the state. But before we get to all that, we have WYPR's John Lee here in studio with us to talk about Baltimore County elections. Voters there had plenty to decide. Party nominations for county executive, 9 county council seats. That's up from the current 7, thanks to a voter-approved referendum that expanded the body, as well as state's attorney, sheriff, and its entire delegation to the Maryland General Assembly. John, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be here, Matt. Thank you.
Well, there were plenty of candidates who declared victory in the hours or days after June 23rd. Plenty, though, were still sweating out all the counting of mail-in ballots that took 2 weeks to tally when those races were outstanding until Monday. What happened when everything was certified? Who was still sweating it out?
Well, as far as sweating it out, I would say one of the interesting races was the state's attorney's race. There was really no sweating out there, which was that Sarah David won that race handily. But the incumbent, Scott Schellenberger, decided not to at least publicly concede. And so we waited. Sarah David decided not to claim victory until the election was certified. That didn't happen until Monday of this week. And then the next day, Schellenberger did concede and offer to help with the transition.
Now, Schellenberger has held that office for close to 2 decades, and in particular, he's been a thorn in the side of his fellow Democrats who've sought reforms on juvenile crimes and charging. How were these candidates different? What will Sarah Davis bring to the office? This is what she said this week.
We worked really, really hard, and we always made sure that we were on message and that we were talking to the residents of Baltimore County. And I think that the hard work there and the engagement with the community is really what resonated in this race.
So what's the difference between these two?
Well, specifically what I can talk about is transparency. What Sarah David said throughout her campaign, very critical of the Schellenberger's office, because she said there just wasn't data available for people to see. She thinks that she says currently there's no data when it comes, for instance, to juvenile crime. You just can't find it in the state's attorney's office. She promises that that will change. Also, she says that, in the past, the prosecutors who are assigned to juvenile cases are often kind of the new guys who are just learning the ropes. She says that too will change. She thinks it's too important that you got to have some seasoned people work in the juvenile cases. But more in general, Matt, she talked about reaching out to the first time offenders and the offenders who perhaps are didn't do anything particularly not a high level crime, that there could be some restorative steps that could be taken to help them in counseling or that sort of thing. But then she's also quick to add that for the more serious crimes from repeat offenders, that would be different, and there has to be consequences. So what all of that means, I think we're just going to have to wait until she takes office, which, by the way, she will, because there was no Republican opponent. There will not be a general election. She will be the next state's attorney.
Now, when she does take over that office, and she said, as you said there, she's going to look over all that she inherits there too. Are there specific policy changes or directives that she talked about on the campaign trail we might expect? Or, as it is with so much in Maryland, with elected officials on the local level, will she go to Annapolis and sort of champion some other changes in front of the General Assembly?
Well, that is something that Scott Schellenberger was certainly well known for, and he was proud of it, that he would go down to Annapolis on a regular basis to try to make change. We'll have to see whether Sarah David does that as well. She really talked a lot about, as I mentioned before, about transparency. And she's also, when I talked to her recently about winning, she said she really has to get into the office and see what's there. And she spoke highly of the prosecutors who are there. And so I think at this point that she says she's going to have a transition team. She has to get in there and see what the office is all about. And then I think we'll start seeing more specifics when it comes to policies.
Now, as we said, county voters had two extra council races to choose nominees for this year. Now, a couple of those primaries did actually come down to Monday in the final counting of ballots. So take us through all of those. Again, two extra council seats because of what voters approved 2 years ago with the referendum. So who's facing whom this fall? What are you looking for?
Well, as far as sweating it out, there were certainly two races that came down to the bitter end on who won. And that was in District 2, west side of the county. Was about a 30-vote difference in the Democratic primary between Ruben Amaya and Lawrence Williams. So that was close race number one. The second one, go over to the east side, Dundalk, District 9, where Arkea Wade defeated Mark McCluskey by about 40 votes. So really close election there. So those were the two close ones. As far as races to watch, there's actually some trends to look at here, too. Chances are, once the general election is over, and we have to remember there's still a general election, it's not over yet, all of these races are contested in November. But if the Democrats hold serve in a couple of the districts on the west side, you'll see two young guys on the council. You'll see Ruben Amaya and Carson Kamenetz. They're both in their mid-20s. They're both Democrats and Democratic leaning at very least districts, so they could be on the council. We were talking about the expansion of the council. The idea, at least one of them, was to make the council more diverse. Of the nine council seats in the general election, there will be seven women on the ballot. So there's certainly an opportunity there. Well, currently it's an all-male club at the Baltimore County Council. You can certainly see where that may change. If you want to look at a race where that is probably most likely to happen, you would look to Makita Scott. She's in District 3, also on the west side. And she's a Democrat. She won the primary in a Democratic-leaning district for sure. And so I would say she has a really good shot of becoming not just a woman on the county council, but the first black woman to serve on the Baltimore County Council.
Julian Jones declared victory last week in the Democratic primary for county executive. He spoke with reporters after doing so. You were there, and you were asking him about his Republican opponent this fall, again noting there still is a general election, no matter how much Democrats may be favored. What did you ask him, and what did he have to say?
Well, that's right, Matt. I just got a feeling at that news conference that there was this feeling that it was over, and it's not over. There is still a general election to be waged. And so I wanted to get him on the record to say, will you debate your Republican opponent, Pat Dwyer?
Well, I'm sure we'll make it happen. Believe me when I tell you, I'm not scared. I've been doing this for 12 years, chairman for 4 years. I'm pretty sure I can handle a debate.
All right. So it sounds to me like we'll get a debate of some sort between those two in the fall. Certainly hope so anyway. I want to share a story, though, Matt, that happened on election night just to get a sense of just how much emotion was tied up into this election between Julian Jones and Izzy Patoka. They were the two front running candidates for sure. I happened to be at the last precinct on the last hour of the election where both of those gentlemen showed up. That was just a coincidence. And I sat there and watched them not interact with each other, kind of circle around each other. You never saw the shaking of the hands or any of that sort of thing. Because these two guys had been working on this election for years and had raised $1 million+, and it was coming down to that. And so I think certainly for Izzy Patoka, he sent out a message to his supporters thanking them and said something to the effect of, I just needed a little time. And so when you get so much invested in one of these elections and you come up short, It's got to be difficult.
Now, another thing you inquired about at that press conference with Julian Jones, and something your reporting has reflected, is what the future of the Inspector General's office will be under a potential Jones administration. That's important because Jones was investigated by the IG twice as a county councilman. Remind us what those were for, and what is the future of the Inspector General's office and what it might be under Jones as county executive?
Sure. One of the investigations involved him putting a donate link on an email, but it was an email that was a county council official council email. You're not supposed to do that. It has to be two separate worlds. You have the council over here and then you have the campaign over there. So she pointed that out. It's not legal. And he did fix that. The second one was she said that he had been helping somebody who owned a commercial alleyway to get government money to fix it. That also isn't supposed to happen. He said he was just trying to help constituents. He does it every day. He said it wasn't a big deal, but still, then Inspector General Kelly Madigan did a report that again kind of was a slap on the wrist to him. So he had a contentious relationship with Kelly Madigan throughout her time, including at least a couple of efforts of trying to rein in her independence. Of course, in the end, what happened was the long story about the attempt to try to replace Ms. Madigan. She stayed on, but she decided to go on to the Howard County to be the inspector general there. So right now, Baltimore County has not had an inspector general since the first week of January when Ms. Madigan left. And there's no inspector general on the horizon. County Executive Kathy Klausmeier says she's not going to appoint one. And then significantly, Matt, in November, voters will be voting on a question on the ballot. And if that question passes, which they usually do, we'll have to see, then an independent panel will be created. And that panel will then select the inspector general. The idea is to take the politics out of it. So theoretically, we could see a situation where if Julian Jones wins in November and he's the county executive, he actually will not be involved in the choice of the inspector general. But what he will very much be involved in is the funding of the inspector general's office. And I did ask him about that. And he said something to the effect of it will be funded appropriately, but he would not guarantee that it would be funded at the current level or at higher levels.
John Lee, he is WIPR's reporter covering Baltimore County. Thank you, as always, for coming in.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Up next, we talk about the money that went into the Baltimore County election, public and private. Sapna Bansal with our news partners at the Baltimore Banner is coming on to tell us all about that. This is the WIPR News Roundup. Stay with us after this short break.
Support for WIPR comes from Watermark, exploring the history and culture of the Chesapeake Bay from the water with daily cruises in Annapolis and Baltimore. Watermark is offering special cruises all summer long. More at watermarkjourney.com.
LGBTQ plus people have long been part of Maryland's story, but their histories have often gone untold. In the latest episode of Maryland Unfolded, Dr. Kalima Young speaks with Ben Eagerman about the state's LGBTQ plus past and his new book, A Gay Little History of Maryland. Maryland Unfolded is available on the first and third Thursdays of the month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and is made possible in part by Gallagher LLP.
Baltimore Public Media's new Next Film Festival welcomes Oscar-nominated filmmaker Deborah Granick of Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace to the Charles Theater for a special screening of episodes of her new documentary series, Con Body vs. Everybody, on Wednesday, July 15th. She'll be joined by WIPR's Erica Kane for a conversation about the nonfiction series' insights to building community and breaking the cycle of recidivism. Tickets and more info at WIPR.org.
A federal program that helps schools pay for internet access is under review by the FCC over concerns about screen time, what its loss would mean for students. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered weekdays at 4 right here on WIPR at 88.1.
And welcome back to WIPR's News Roundup, our weekly show examining some of the big issues facing Baltimore, the region, and the state of Maryland. I'm Matt Bush. To talk to us about the money that went into Baltimore County's primary election last month, we have Sapna Bansal. She's with our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, joining us on the line. Welcome to the show, Sapna.
Thank you for having me.
Now, earlier this week, you had a story about public financing for county elections in the banner. This is the first election that candidates have had a public funding option available to them in Baltimore County. But at that point, when your story came out, the full vote tally hadn't come in. So tell us now, now that we know that full tally, how did the candidates with public funding make out versus those who use their own money or raise their own money? And how much money are we talking about in these cases, too?
Sure. So the publicly financed candidates, I would say, was a bit of a mixed bag. So in the county executive race, the only candidate who qualified was Pat Young. He received about $196,000 in public funds for his campaign. And he finished fourth out of fifth candidates in the county executive race. He was going up against, three very well-funded opponents, two of whom raised over $1 million. When we spoke with him on the phone after the election, he sort of felt like, he got drowned out on television, especially in the final weeks of the campaign by those better funded candidates. Conversely, on the council, there was many of the council candidates who used public financing actually did quite well. So there were four publicly financed council candidates who won their race. Paul Dongara in District 1, which is Catonsville. Ruben Amaya in District 2, which on the west side as well. Makita Scott in District 3, also on the west side. And then Sean McIntosh, who ran unopposed in her Democratic primary in District 5, which is sort of the rural North County. So we had four publicly financed council candidates who won their races. And so overall, what it seemed like was public financing was certainly something of it leveled the playing field for those candidates who used it in the council races. But with the large amounts of money that were being raised in the county executive race, public financing couldn't fully keep up.
So this was brought in, again, as some of the things you said there, was brought in to try to help get a more diverse group of candidates running and maybe even succeeding in Baltimore County elections. Now, we're having this conversation as Maine's soon-to-be former Democratic Senate nominee Graham Plantner, accused of sexual assault, stepped down from the race there this week. He is denying the insult, and instead he's blaming the political structure for his decision.
We're doing it because of the structures that are being taken away from us by those in power.
And Baltimore County, the public funding effort was approved as a way to level the playing field. You just said it turned out a kind of a mixed bag. So going forward, what do you think of any changes may come to it if these initial goals were kind of a mixed bag of whether or not they were reached?
Well, I would say that even the candidates who won with public financing cited some issues that they felt like they had with it. And I would say the main issue that was sort of a universal theme amongst people who tried public financing was that the county has unusually high thresholds to qualify for public financing. So compared to neighboring counties, basically all the counties in the Baltimore metro area have public financing, as well as Montgomery and Prince George's County. The thresholds to qualify for taxpayer funds for your campaign in Baltimore County are sort of unusually high. And so many of these candidates who were using public financing, they do not have established donor bases. They are using public financing sort of because they are new candidates. You mentioned, a number of them are minorities, and they don't have those established donor networks. And so to raise, to meet sort of these elevated thresholds using small dollar donations was very, very challenging. And it's Baltimore County's thresholds are actually higher than neighboring counties or nearby counties that have larger populations and are wealthier. So for example, in the council race, the council candidates had to raise $15,000 from 150 small dollar donors to receive public funds. Howard County, by comparison, the requirement was $10,000. Anne Arundel, which has a new public financing system too, required only $7,500. So many people had sort of an appetite for or express an appetite to lower those thresholds and maybe make them more in line with neighboring jurisdictions.
Sapna Bansal covers the Baltimore County for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. Great story this morning from her about the bus crash that took place this week in Pikesville along Reisterstown Road and the dangers of that particular area where the crash took place. Certainly suggest all our listeners to go check that story out. Sapna, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we head to south to Venezuela to hear about the recovery from two devastating earthquakes that hit the country. Then we'll talk about a new documentary from Maryland Public Television that tells the story of the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights here in Maryland. That's all next on the WYPR News Roundup. Stay with us.
Your Child's Brain is celebrating its fifth podcast anniversary. That's 5 years, 60 episodes, and more than 95 experts who've shared insights on everything from autism to epilepsy to adaptive sports. Your Child's Brain is produced by Kennedy Krieger Institute with assistance from WYPR. Check it out at WYPR.org, KennedyKrieger.org/YCB, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Practical Parenting, a podcast produced by GBMC, helps empower parents in the trenches and find joy in the magical mess of summer. The sun is out and so are the schedules. But don't worry, we have your back. New episodes drop every other Friday. Tune in to get all the resources, support, and confidence you need to thrive through the chaos. Practical Parenting, available on WYPR.org, the mobile app, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I grew up in China. Went to college at a coastal city called Tianjin. Never heard of it? It's okay. Small town, 14 million population.
Join us for true stories of leaving home, tennis rivalries, and Cameroon. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Don't miss the Moth Radio Hour every Saturday at 2 in the afternoon here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1.
And welcome back to WYPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, news director of the award-winning WYPR Newsroom. This week, we're crossing the Caribbean Sea from Baltimore to Venezuela, where more than 2 weeks ago, two devastating earthquakes killed thousands of people, destroyed buildings, and devastated families.
I'm here because my son is under the rubble. Like my son, there are hundreds of others trapped here.
The founder of one of Baltimore's most popular Spanish-language news outlets, Latin Opinion, also calls Baltimore home. Eric Oribio has lived here for over three decades and is Venezuelan. He joins us now in studio with his brother Ronald, who has also worked in energy and infrastructure. Sorry to reach out to you, sir, during such a difficult time, but to both of you, thank you so much for coming on the show. You're right there.
Hello, Matt, and thank you for having us here.
Nothing.
And thank you for support this initiative to talk about Venezuela in this difficult time for the Venezuelan people. And thank you for having us here today.
Eric, we'll start with you. You were slated to talk with us about SEAL 250 just 2 weeks ago that was taking place here in Baltimore. You've been involved in similar events in the past, but the day before we recorded that show on June 24th, you, like so many, received news of these earthquakes striking Venezuela, a 7.5 quake and then a 7.2 quake, those on the Richter scale. Were you here in Baltimore at the time? What happened when you heard the news?
Well, we were shocking. Especially because we have too many friends. Our home in Caracas is very close to La Guaira, where is the international airport, and it's completely devastated. We have friends that passed away the same day. And we definitely impact and trying to move to see what we can do to support and bring donations, and thanks to the media that support our activity, we have a great result, a lot of volunteers, people making donations. It was a great moment, but we are still shocking. Last night, we sleep just a few hours. We have a lot of friends and still there. The odor in the area is bad. The rescue team, they do not recover dead people, they just people alive. and it's hundreds and hundreds of people trying to recover the bodies. No few resources, just water. We need food, we need medicine. It will take a long time to recover it, but definitely we were very shocking, and we're still working on it.
Ronald, what was your experience like? Where were you when you heard about this?
I was here in Baltimore. And for me, it was also, you know, I went through shock and disbelief. Even though I'm a geologist and I understand, you know, why this happened and you know, where it comes from, and I was aware that something like this could happen at some time. But initially, you know, not thinking that something like this could be happening, you know, at home. You know, what was home for us for so many years. And then, of course, you know, the worry about, you know, our loved ones, friends, family who still live down there, and anxiety about, you know, not knowing the uncertainty, you know, not knowing, you know, their whereabouts. And of course, then that translated to grief after understanding the number of victims, of the number of people who have died and families who have been destroyed. And now just hoping, even though this is going to take a long time for Venezuela to recover, you know, hoping that, you know, the international aid will continue coming for the next months, if not years.
Now, in the pages of Latin Opinion Baltimore, you've had information on flights in and out of the country as of yesterday. Most of the international flights resumed, though it has not returned to normal. You also have on your on Latin Opinion Baltimore, you have other resources for Venezuelans both here and how they can help. What sorts of things are you hearing from people, and what sorts of things are you asking them?
At this moment, after we collect several donations, okay, we just recommend to go to the United Way, Central Maryland United Way, with a proof record to doing very good for our society. At this point, we are promoting the United Way link to make donation. This is a very crucial point, topic, because if you don't do the donation directly to the people, it's in risk to disappear or to be stolen. Ronald, can you talk a little bit about the...
Yeah, I would say, you know, that donations, either cash or items, are essential. And especially if those get to the organizations that are really trusted and that really have a good idea of, you know, where the needs are at and what those needs are in terms of, you know, medical supplies, food, you know, different types of, you know, shelter. There are so many different things that are urgently needed. But there are organizations that have that well mapped out. So contacting those trusted organizations may make a significant difference.
Politics, unfortunately, a very big part of what's going on right now with the response and all that. The UN and Venezuela asking for sanctions relief and the release of some frozen assets. Trump administration has given close to $400 million. That's not a small amount, but in comparison to what would maybe sent to Haiti after the 2010 earthquake there was $3 billion. What are your thoughts on the U.S. response so far?
Well, we feel that the U.S. has responded effectively to this emergency. And, of course, you know, the need goes well beyond what the U.S. can do at the moment. So international aid is needed from other countries as well and offer different organizations worldwide. But the U.S. has been effectively helping out and in many different ways.
We have to remember the embassy was closed for many years. Mm-hmm. They just opened and start the relationship. And also, we have been here, Matt, between Venezuela and Baltimore, like a bridge, several ships from Venezuela. They made maintenance for several years here in Baltimore. Also, we're looking for government support. We have the Port of Baltimore. We can send container because it's just starting. It will take a long time to recover this situation.
As the political situation in Venezuela impacted this, obviously, at the beginning of the year, President Maduro was taken by the U.S. forces, brought back to the United States. The acting president stopped air traffic briefly when a potential presidential contender was trying to get back into the country. You were both imprisoned for 6 months under the Maduro government, and a bipartisan team of senators helped release you. Is there a way to separate the politics from the situation there right now, or is it just part of it, and you have to work around it to make sure that the people who need things right now in Venezuela are getting them?
Yeah, well, we know that, you know, politics is getting in the way at the moment because the government is not helping effectively people. And that has been already, you know, communicated by not only the people suffering the impact of this crisis, but also, you know, international journalists, you know, have been reporting on this fact. So the government has not been, at least initially, you know, for the first 2 to 3 days, they were not really helping. And so they became, you know, more a barrier than, you know, than real support. So politics is definitely affecting or making this a greater disaster.
Well, thank you to you both for coming in, Ronald and Eric Oribio. Eric is the founder of Baltimore's Latin Opinion News. Ronald worked in the energy field in that country. And if you were looking to help donate, obviously go to Latin Opinion here in Baltimore and read about some ways you can do that. Again, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you very much, Matt. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Matt. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Coming up on the News Roundup, a new documentary examining the history of Maryland's law enforcement officer Bill of Rights, what it meant in cases of police brutality and violence, and what it means to have it repealed. That's coming up next after the break. You're listening to the WYPR News Roundup. Stay with us.
Support for WIPR comes from Broadmead, a life plan community. Broadmead's first ever off-site campus, Broadmead at Ridgebrook, is under development, featuring 80 new homes crafted for comfort and independence nestled within a 60-acre campus. More information at broadmead.org, an equal opportunity housing provider.
Baltimore Public Media brings a double dose of Sunday morning tunes to the Maryland State Fair September 13th. First, it's Pop Princesses with Enzlo at 11:30. Pitch perfect hits from Taylor, Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, and many more. Then at 2:30, it's a K-pop dance party from BTS to Demon Hunters with singers backed by a 10-person dance troupe. Dress your best for both September 13th. Tickets on sale now include fair admission. Details at WTMD.org.
Recently on Wait, Wait, Alzo Slade questioned whether Joelle Nicole Johnson was really a soccer fan.
She's just looking at legs the whole time.
I'm not just looking at legs, Alzo. I'm also looking at butts.
I'm Peter Sagal. We will be dressed modestly for this week's show from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, with special guest musician Jason Narducci. Join us for this week's Wait, Wait, the news quiz from NPR.
And don't miss Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me every Saturday at 10 a.m. here on WIPR. Proud partner with the nonprofit news site, the Baltimore Banner. Together, WIPR and the Banner are bringing local news you can trust in Maryland. Learn more at thebanner.com.
And welcome back to WIPR's News Roundup. I'm News Director Matt Bush. There's a new documentary streaming now on PBS and Maryland Public Television, Breaking the Blue Wall. It looks back at a law that was on Maryland's books for almost half a century, the LEOBOR, or Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights. What it did, according to the ACLU, was provide police with extra rights no matter how clear the evidence or how horrible the conduct. Short of being convicted in a court of law of a felony, a police chief could not discipline an officer. A criminologist professor reviewed the law in Maryland, called it, quote, an invitation to misconduct. Documentary filmmaker and professor of journalism at Morgan State University, Alyssa Figueroa, says she asked the police union many times about the law and received no response. Maryland was the first to adopt this law and was the first to repeal it. What was the history of the law and what has it meant for the safety of people in Maryland today? To answer that question, Alyssa Vigoro is here with us in studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We also have on the line Tawanda Jones. Her brother Tyrone West was beaten and died in police custody in 2013. It was ruled by a homicide by Maryland's Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. Thank you for being on the show, Tawanda.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is former Maryland Senator Joe Carter, who worked to get the law repealed in Annapolis. Thank you for joining us, Senator.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Alyssa, thanks for coming in. Why did you make this film? And when you approached law enforcement about it, what was their response to you?
I actually started working on this a long time ago, back in 2020. I was interested in looking at what happens after a massive protest movement like we were seeing in that summer. And once I started looking into it in Maryland, the thing that really jumped out to me that everyone told me to look at was the fact that the LEOBR had never been touched. Even though we entered into this consent decree in 2017, there was this long reform process. The basis of this law, despite lots of efforts starting way before the 2015 protests that happened here after the death of Freddie Gray, that law had never been really dealt with in any way. And so there was a big effort that year in 2020 to 2021 to repeal it. And I thought that would be an interesting thing to document and also to go back a little bit and try to understand, well, how do we get here, right? How do you get to this place where a law had been on the books for so many years and so resistant to any kind of change, significant change at least. So that was really the impetus to start looking into it. And yeah.
And so I want to turn to you next. The name Tyrone West probably sounds very familiar to many of us here in Baltimore. But I don't know if everyone remembers what happened to your brother and why the law enforcement officer Bill of Rights was so important for you in your search for justice. So tell us about that.
Thanks for asking me that. So for people that's tuning in that doesn't know anything about my brother Tyrone West, unfortunately, he was unalived in 2013 and literally like beat to death in broad daylight. It was horrific. An unarmed man that wasn't doing anything wrong, wasn't breaking any laws or anything. And back then, we struggled to understand why we couldn't get like no type of accountability, you know, and the law enforcement officer Bill of Rights played a major role into it. Like they had like 10 days to get pretty much an interview. Whereas though if my brother Tyrone West would have did the things that was done upon him, he would have got interrogated on the spot. Like literally, and some of the officers went down like literally a month or two later. Not even within those 10 days, they went like a month or two later to give a statement and they suited up with their lawyers. You know, it was really devastating. So it definitely played a crucial part as to why my family did not get accountability, along with a lot of other many factors.
Senator Carter, there is a moment near the beginning of the film where you put this issue in very stark terms.
Law enforcement officers are the only persons that have a legal right to kill. And with that right that they have, there's a great amount of responsibility that should go along with it, but it doesn't.
Why was repealing this law in Annapolis so important to you during your time there?
Well, for situations like Tawanda and Tyrone West, but at the time that we finally got around to repealing the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights, there were no less than 500 documented cases of Marylanders killed at the hands of police by the ACLU. And so year after year, I was in Annapolis, very concerned that we were very troubled as a legislative body about injustice. But here was an injustice that for many, many years, everyone was afraid to touch. And so this was one of the most difficult battles of my career. And it took years of persistence and coalition building. But we still, I want to be clear, we still have more to do.
Now, Lisa, one of the things in the documentary is a lot of historical footage you were able to find and some interviews. There are a few voices talking about the time when this was passed.
This is the era of incredible militant social movement across the board in the United States, but in particular civil rights and black power movements. It's the era of the urban uprisings, the so-called riots.
To all who have been victimized, I pledge to you that all possible power will be exerted to restore order and security to your lives.
And this led to the Kerner Commission report that called for more reform, that called for police oversight and civilian review boards. And so the police, their authority is being challenged. It's a difficult job.
Actually, an assault on a policeman is an assault on law. And when people realize that it is an assault on the due process of law, they'll see this entire thing in a new perspective.
And so as a result, police unions start to be able to make a different kind of case for their existence and for their access to political power and to labor rights.
Now, Maryland was the first to adopt this Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights and then the first to repeal it. So taking us back to 1974 from what you found for the documentary, why was it passed? Why this particular law was so important?
This was a unique moment in American history, not only in Maryland, but across the country, in Detroit, in New York, in Philly, you see the beginning of the burgeoning police union movement. So police unions were not accepted widely by the public or by the union movement. Organized labor did not love police officers. They broke up strikes. But it was a moment where things were starting to shift. a few things happening all at the same time. There was a growth in public sector unions. Sanitation workers were being organized in Baltimore City at the same time that the police were being organized, actually by the same union, AFSCME. And in addition to that, police officers were able to make a pitch in this moment that they really couldn't before, which was basically, we are the line between chaos and civility, right? We keep the body politic safe. Prior to this, this was a moment when cities were changing, right? We have white flight. We have, after the riots in 1968, kind of hollowing out of urban areas in Baltimore, Newark, all these different places. So the police also start to have a different role. They're going in to try to prevent crime in some of these neighborhoods, which leads to these high-profile clashes. So the police can also point to these moments and say, you know, we need extra protection. So I think it was a little bit of a perfect storm of a lot of factors, social, political, that were coming together at this moment that allowed for the passage of this law. And the law, after it passed here, passed in Florida, and over the next decades, was transported to something like more than 20 states. So Maryland was kind of on the vanguard, though, because of all of these dynamics coming into play in this place.
So for each of you, the last question, took half a century or so for this to be repealed. What do you think, what did work in the end to finally have this law repealed?
I don't know if one of the other ladies wants to answer.
You can go first.
I think finally...
Finally, the world saw through George Floyd on videotape what actually happened, and we were able to explain that this wasn't unique, that George Floyd wasn't unique, and right here in Maryland, it had happened 500 times at least. And so I think that was what happened, the videotaping, where people could not deny that what happened happened.
To you, Tawanda.
And and I echo some of that of what Jill said. Definitely the piece about with George Floyd, when the world was forced to watch and the pandemic and come together at one time and not turn off their devices and just sat there and watch, and just consistency. And I've been persistent, nonstop fighting for all these weeks, 676 weeks, and I'm going to continue until we get accountability. We still haven't got it yet, but we definitely going to keep on fighting, boots on the ground, because again, that was just a little small pinch of a chip. We have a lot of fighting to go, literally. A lot of fighting, especially with someone just being unalived in Baltimore City just on Sunday, like it has not stopped. So, in fact, it's gotten worse. So we're going to keep on fighting.
Tawanda Jones still holds West Wednesdays, a vigil to her brother Tyrone West. Former Maryland Senator Joe Carter worked to repeal the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights. Alyssa Figueroa is the producer and filmmaker of Breaking the Blue Wall. It's now streaming on Maryland Public Television and PBS. Definitely check it out. Thank you all so much for coming in and discussing this with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Next up, ice cream across Maryland. Not just a taste, but the whole scoop. Stay with us. You're listening to the WYPR News Roundup. Fantastic. Thank you.
WYPR is a media partner with the Friends of Patterson Park Concert Series, presenting Downtown Tumbao, a Baltimore multi-generational Latin jazz band that merges Afro-Caribbean and Brazilian beats, this Sunday, July 12th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Patterson Park Observatory. More information at pattersonpark.com.
Your child's brain is celebrating its fifth podcast anniversary. That's 5 years, 60 episodes, and more than 95 experts who've shared insights on everything from autism to epilepsy to adaptive sports. Your Child's Brain is produced by Kennedy Krieger Institute with assistance from WYPR. Check it out at WYPR.org, KennedyKrieger.org/YCB, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Baltimore Public Media's New Next Film Festival welcomes Oscar-nominated filmmaker Deborah Granick of Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace to the Charles Theater for a special screening of episodes of her new documentary series, Con Body vs. Everybody, on Wednesday, July 15th. She'll be joined by WYPR's Erica Kane for a conversation about the nonfiction series' insights to building community and breaking the cycle of recidivism. Tickets and more info at WYPR.org.
WIPR is a proud partner with the nonprofit news site, the Baltimore Banner. Together, WIPR and the Banner are bringing local news you can trust to Maryland. Learn more at thebanner.com.
And welcome back to WIPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. Last week, we saw scorching hot temperatures around the 4th of July holiday. The Baltimore region experienced 3 days in a row of triple digit heat, combined with our lovely Chesapeake humidity that we love so much. Here at WIPR, we're trying to beat the heat a few ways, most notably eating ice cream. This year, the Maryland Departments of both Agriculture and Natural Resources are encouraging residents to get out into nature and meet the cows that made their ice cream, while also grabbing a scoop. It's Maryland's Best Ice Cream Trail. Kristen Hanna, the Director of Special Projects at the Department of Agriculture, joins us now. Kristen, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
And we're also joined in studio by Simone Phillips, founder and creator of the food blog and dining guide Charm City Table. And you're going to tell us all about the local ice cream treats for those trying to beat the heat here in Baltimore City, because it's not going away for a while, if ever. No. Simone, thanks for being on the show.
Feels like it. Thanks for having me.
Kristen, we'll start with you. For those who've never been to a dairy farm, tell us what it's like actually exploring an ice cream trail and seeing where their ice cream comes from.
Yeah, so the great thing is that you're getting outdoors and you're actually seeing where the ice cream comes from. So many of our farms have the cows right there on site. For example, South Mountain Creamery, you can actually go and pet the cows. And you really get to see the true connection between where our food comes from and, of course, enjoy a delicious cup of ice cream.
You've been out there. How does the ice cream taste itself? And does the taste change once you meet the cows that are responsible for it?
Absolutely. It's better, right? Especially once you know their name. I've definitely been out there. The trail has been around for 14 years now. This is my third year with the department, and it's my favorite time of year by far.
I wonder what the cows would think of ice cream, don't you? What do you think they'd say?
I think they'd be proud.
Well, Simone, we'll change to you now locally. For those of us in the city of Baltimore, what's the ice cream landscape of? I live in Fed Hill, and I have five within three blocks.
Yes.
That's everywhere.
I wish it was everywhere. Yeah, Fed Hill is definitely the hot spot for all the ice cream places, but we have so many in the downtown area in greater Baltimore City. You go to North Baltimore, you can have Sydney's ice creams, and like you said, Federal Hill, you can have everything from Taharka to Moo Moo Cows, and there's just so many places. Of course, Be More Licks, you know, another favorite. So you can get local ice cream everywhere in Baltimore City.
Now, a lot of ice cream brands in the city and the county have interesting stories and whimsical flavors. We have some right now that we're going to try.
Yes.
Vegan pistachio from Cajou Creamery, olive oil and sea salt, two things I think probably 5 to 10 years ago no one ever would have thought would be an ice cream.
That's right.
That's from Taharka Brothers, and two sandwiches from the Charmery, strawberry and coconut. While we try them, can you tell us about these businesses? What makes them so special?
I think what makes these businesses special, aside from the fun, whimsical, delicious flavors, are their stories. These are family-owned, locally-owned businesses, and you walk into these ice cream shops, or worker-owned, like Taharka Brothers. You walk into these ice cream shops and these ice cream parlors, and you can actually meet the people who were a crucial part of making the ice cream and coming up with these fun, exciting flavors. So I think similar to the cows who help make them, you know, the people who actually come together and make these flavors make it even more special.
Now, you both feature local products or local food through your projects, either from farms around the state or from local businesses. For both of you, why is it so important to eat locally? Well, Kristen, we'll go with you first.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's important to eat locally because you're helping your friends and neighbors, which are our farmers that are in the state. And so, you know, it's really hard to be a dairy farm nowadays. And so these products like ice cream make them more profitable. But also you get to enjoy a truly delicious locally made product. And so the money stays in our economy, which we all know helps us all in the end.
Yeah, similarly, helping your friends and neighbors. These, like I said, you walk in these ice cream places and you meet the owners and you meet their children and, you know, even the folks that they've hired, they're all from Baltimore, from the Baltimore area. So that money goes right back into the local economy. So,
is there something specific about Baltimore that makes it? I do want to say these olive oil and sea salt one is very savory. And I would have to think again, 5 years ago, savory ice cream wasn't a thing. It absolutely is now. Is there something specific about Baltimore? Again, I live near Be More Licks, you mentioned. That line in the summer
is, I mean, it feels like it would be almost an hour long.
Yeah.
People waiting, and people do it very willingly. So is there really something about the city and its connection to ice cream that might be different than other cities?
Oh, besides it being scorching hot?
Well, I mean that, yeah. I mean, we can't, again, that Chesapeake community we love so much, is, you know, that's part of our lives.
Yes, so, it's a part of our lives and really a part of our history. It's always been a hot, humid summer here in Baltimore. So I think we want a cool treat. You know, Baltimore's known for their snowballs.
There's others, yeah.
And, cream, you know, there are other, sweet, cold treats we have in the summertime. But I also think these ice cream shops, they truly have something for everyone. You go to a Be More Licks and there are tons of flavors and there's plant-based and there's gluten-free. You just have so many options. So when you think about going to have an affordable, cool treat in the summer for with your family and friends, ice cream is a great step.
Kristen, talking about this ice cream trail that people can do this summer, what would you like for them to know about it before they head out and do it?
Yeah, there's a free digital pass that you can get on marylandsbest.net, or you can pick up paper copies in any of our participating locations if you want to stay off tech. And as you visit each location, including the trails, you get points, and those points can be redeemed for prizes like a coffee mug, a hat, and stickers. So it's just a really fun way to get your friends and family out of the house this summer and explore Maryland.
All right, big question for all of you, for both of you. Favorite flavor?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask that.
it's a tough one. I can't answer it either.
Yeah. I love to try all of them, but my classic favorite is strawberry.
Oh, I don't want to go with the classic flavor, so I'm going to go with Honey Graham from Taharka Brothers. I grew up eating a lot of graham crackers, and so it feels like my childhood in a cup. It's really good.
Interesting. Yeah. I guess, actually, last question, too. It mentioned it isn't just ice cream that's around here. There's also, as you said, snow cones are a thing here, too.
Snowballs.
Did I say snow cones? Oh, my goodness. I apologize to the whole city for saying that.
Yes.
So snowballs, but then also a lot of water ice is coming down from Philadelphia,
so
too.
Much,
is there, you know, we can have all three, right?
Yes, we love Tia's Italian Ice. I know there's a local spot called Noel's as well that does Italian ice. We can have all three. We can have more. Bring us all the cold, delicious treats to try.
Well, to beat the heat this summer, find what you like, but ice cream's always there. It's very plentiful here in Baltimore. Simone Phillips is founder and creator of Charm City Table. Thank you so much for coming in to the studio today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Kristen Hanna is the director of special projects at the Maryland Department of Agriculture. Check out that best ice cream trail. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for the WYPR News Roundup this week. We're going to be back next week. We're going to talk about summer travel. And also traffic. Stay safe out there. I'm Matt Bush, the news director of the award-winning WYPR Newsroom. Isaac Moss, Elizabeth Nonemaker, and Mallory Pinkard-Pierre helped us with production today. Shania Mapson and Sean Murphy are studio engineers, and Amy Walters is WYPR's executive producer. Thanks for listening, and stay cool.